First Ottoman Assaults, April the 2nd through April the 19th, 1453. The Conquest of Constantinople, Part 3, Episode 25.
They found the Turks coming right up under the walls and seeking battle, particularly the Janissaries. And when one or two of them were killed, at once more Turks came and took away the dead ones, without caring how near they came to the city walls. Our men shot at them with guns and crossbows, aiming at the Turk who was carrying away his dead countrymen, and both of them would fall to the ground dead, and then there came other Turks and took them away, none fearing death, but being willing to let 10 of themselves be killed, rather than suffer the shame of leaving a single Turkish corpse by the walls.
What you just heard narrated by the ever-master of audio creation, Soren Narnia, was a first-hand account of Mehmed's bloody assault against the central wall of Constantinople on April the 18th, 1453. Recorded for our sake by a Venetian official who was present during the siege, it illustrates for us a brutal fact about warfare. A commander, a politician, leader, or whatever, can undergo all the planning, diplomatic maneuvering, and strategizing all he wants to. They say that in warfare, the amateur thinks in terms of tactics, and the veteran in terms of logistics. And all of this is true. However, Mehmed was about to find out during the siege and fall and conquest of Constantinople that all the tactical maneuvering and diplomatic strategizing, well, it can simply all come down to a last-minute assault, a brutal, frontal attack on a walled city. Sultan Mehmed II marched down from Edirne after having raised the three horsetails, or four in his case, as a traditional sign of his authority. Over the winter months, the Ottomans had assembled one of the most impressive armies ever seen. In the Conquest of Constantinople series, Part 2, I went into detail on exactly what Mehmed's army looked like. It was professional, although that term may be a bit misleading when we hear it with our modern ears. It was led by some of the most highly experienced and talented commanders the Muslim world had gathered into one place since the age of the great caliphates 100 years ago. It was motivated by religious zeal, fear of Mehmed, greed for gold and treasure, lust for women and slaves, and a driving economic labor, an engine that was demanding cheap male Christian workers to work the fields in Rumelia and Anatolia. However, all of Mehmed's planning, as we shall see, didn't mean he wasn't immune from the necessity of ordering suicidal frontal assaults, attacks which were driven back with terrible losses for the Ottomans, as we have just heard illustrated for us by Soren Narnia. On April the 2nd, the vanguard of the Ottoman military machine arrived outside the Theodosian walls of Constantinople. If you were a Byzantine soldier, let's say, picture yourself perched atop one of the many turrets looking out from the ramparts. You would have seen on April the 2nd the Ottoman army arrive by their tens of thousands. Slowly, these tens of thousands would break down into groups of 300 to 500 men, screened and protected by thousands of Sipahi cavalry, whom were arriving by the hour and riding everywhere unchecked outside the walls. These groups of men, being screened by the Sipahi, sweated in the April sun, and they worked like absolute madmen. The steady tapping of tent poles being set up, strings lined up to triangulate precisely where the Sultan's tent should go, scribes everywhere correcting lines, trenches being dug directly under the walls. It must have seemed like a crazy flurry of chaotic motion, yet underlying the movements was a kind of order. As the sun set that April the 2nd, you would have seen tents springing up by their tens of thousands and a large ditch dug in front of the tents. and behind the ditch the Ottomans had erected a 5-foot-tall pre-built wooden rampart assembled for protection of the camp. All in all, the Ottomans were just 250 or so meters away from the walls. By night, you would have seen torches, more and more being lit as additional enemy forces arrived. The smell of lamb, spices, strong tea could be picked up faintly by your nose, as your own rumbling belly would drive hunger pangs, only to be offered up dried bread and old ale. The next day, April the 3rd, from your vantage behind the Theodosian walls, would have been awed by an absolute sea of tents. The fabric was thick wool and cotton, some white, others blue, and an uncountable forest of banners, flags, and crescents, and horsetails flying all over the place in the breeze. As the day wore on, more and more Ottoman military units arrived to take up positions opposite the wall. Turkish war drums and Ottoman military bands, perhaps as many as 1,000, played all day and throughout the night. Finally, on April the 5th, the trumpet sounded from the Ottoman camp in the early morning. Sultan Mehmed II had finally arrived, along with his full contingent of Janissaries and vassal troops from various parts of his empire's fringes. Mehmed ordered his tent set up directly in front of the weaker central wall. In front of his tent, he was laying down plans to put Orban's giant royal cannon, so that he could personally oversee its operation. However, the royal cannon and its smaller sister cannons wouldn't arrive until a few days later. Looking over your shoulder, let's pretend is Emperor Constantine the 11th. He would have cut a tall and lean figure. His face would have been framed in reddish hair. He would have been middle-aged by then, and already a proven natural leader of men. Had the Byzantines been cursed with any of the weak-willed and lousy emperors of the past 100 years, the city might very well have surrendered to the Turks without a fight, and, considering the death, suffering, destruction, slavery, and utter disappearance of the last legacy of the Roman Empire forever, who's to say it wouldn't have been the better option? Constantine the 11th was a different beast from his predecessors. He had ignored offers of asylum from the many courts of Western Europe, and instead had spent every waking hour since the final ascension of Mehmed to the Sultanate figuring out how best to defend his city. Just days prior, he had ordered all the precious vessels containing gold and silver to be rounded up and melted into coin and used to pay the many mercenary soldiers serving on his walls. His men had broken into monasteries, churches, and private establishments. No property, either public or private, was immune, and in decades past, such a move could have cost the emperor not just his throne, but his life. But times were different, as they say. From the Ottoman perspective, and also shared by the wider Islamic world, Constantinople was seen as the apple of the West, or the Red Apple. And there was an old prophecy that a great Muslim leader with a good army, and when the will of God was aligning just right, could take the Christian city and usher in a golden age of Islam. Mehmed, having been educated and raised by the war hawks in his family's court, and reading the mystic poems of Islamic Sufism, believed himself to be this great warrior of the faith from a young age. At his side and in his tent was the Sufi mystic and teacher Akka Sadin, who would prove his weight in gold by helping to uphold the morale of the Ottoman army when it looked like the city wasn't going to fall. Mehmed and his Sufi mystic teacher both saw the coming siege as a fulfillment of the old conflict between Islam and the Roman Empire, which had been raging for over 800 years. It was early morning April the 6th, when Mehmed sent a message to the city of Constantinople, asking them to surrender. If they would surrender, then every life inside the city would be spared. And according to Muslim law, no one would be forced into slavery and the private property would be kept safe. It says a lot that the last Roman emperor, in full armor and with his troops, returned Mehmed's final offer of peace with this.
As to surrendering the city to you, it is not for me to decide, or for anyone else of its citizens. For all of us have reached the mutual decision to die of our own free will, without any regard for our lives.
With this rejection, Mehmed ordered a small-scale bombardment. The Turks did have smaller medium-sized cannons at their disposal, and Mehmed wanted to get the ball rolling and not wait around on his hands for the smaller guns. Several dozen or so cannons fired all up and down the Turkish line, to not much effect against the Theodosian walls. The defenders hunkered down behind the humongous ramparts and turrets, while grapeshot, rocks, spears, and arrows bounce harmlessly off the fortifications. Next, Mehmed ordered his generals to rouse the many volunteer soldiers who had come from all over the place hoping to score some loot. His generals made sure to send up the riffraff, men nobody knew, the fortune seekers, criminals, and those who possess no really useful skills, the cannon fodder, no pun intended. They were lined up in three ranks, and with the Sipahi and Janissaries pressing them forward, they were ordered into a frontal attack. As soon as the defenders heard the trumpets blare and the drums beat, they concentrated on the central wall and easily repelled the attackers with heavy losses. Mehmed had the men rounded up and thrown a second time at the wall. After he was satisfied that their numbers had been sufficiently worn down, he broke up these irregulars into smaller units to be used as laborers, since they weren't an effective fighting force anymore. Some of the sources say that Mehmed didn't really trust these guys, and he had been looking for an excuse to just use them up so that their numbers wouldn't be as big. Satisfied he had at least made a symbolic gesture, Mehmed retired to his tent and eagerly awaited yet more troops, and he was really hoping for his big surprise for the defenders of Constantinople to arrive soon. His big surprise appeared on April the 11th, when a trundling train of men and beasts could be seen in the distance from the vantage of the Theodosian walls. What was this spectacle they must have looked upon? Well, they would have seen 60 oxen and 400 men, all working in tandem to haul a gigantic cannon, the largest cannon the high medieval age had ever seen, an invention of the legendary Orban, slowly coming into sight. This strange and surprisingly advanced invention of the age was an astounding cannon, measuring in at 27 feet long, and it boasted a 33-inch barrel. It fired stone projectiles weighing in at over 1,500 pounds. However, it would take 2 to 3 hours to reload between firings, and the barrel would need to be thoroughly cleaned out and oiled. After a few days of Mehmed's demands to fire higher volleys, its bronze casing would glow red hot and eventually explode. The royal cannon didn't come alone either. Along with it were 10 little sister cannons, all of which were basically clone copies of their bigger brother designed by Orban. Mehmed had the royal cannon placed directly in front of his massive tent, where he could supervise the operation accordingly. Then, the next day on April the 12th, early in the morning, the royal gun, along with its 10 smaller sister weapons, opened fire on the central walls of Constantinople. The royal cannon took, as I said, hours to reload, to make ready to fire again, so the volley was slow in coming. However, the massive 1,500-pound stone landed directly into the wall and lodged itself deep in the structure. The blast could be felt all the way up and down the Golden Horn, and in the harbor, the Christian ship's hulls would reverberate with the concussion from the massive explosion. The damage, however, at the end of the day turned out to be minimal, much to the Ottomans' disappointment. The stone shot at the city simply embedded themselves into the ancient Theodosian walls, and they missed the more important targets, such as the turrets and the gate. And the other 10 giant guns, while certainly bad for morale of the defenders, well, they also did little to bring the walls come a-tumbling down. While all of this was going on, later on that same day, the Ottoman navy began to converge on the Golden Horn and were lining up for a direct assault at the Christian naval vessels guarding the entrance. Watching all of this from the ramparts, Constantine and Giustiniani ordered their men to hunker down and weather the bombard as best they could. For the next 7 days, the Ottomans kept up a steady barrage with their cannons, catapults, and trebuchet systems. For the most part, the projectiles landed in a depopulated city and did little damage inside. After the second day, however, the central Theodosian wall began to show some damage. Giustiniani and his men, the civilian labor battalions helping them, began working round the clock to repair the walls. This was gruesome and dangerous work. Often Giustiniani himself would lead a small counterattack called a sally out of the castle walls, where they would attempt to make a run for the Ottoman lines. These were always driven back, but it kept the Ottomans on their toes, and more importantly, their attention away from the repair efforts going on upon the Theodosian walled system. On April the 18th, the citizens awoke as the sun cracked the horizon to the east of the Golden Horn. The now normal spectacle of waking up to a massive bombardment was met with total silence, and then the slow, eerie beat of the Turkish war drums. And then the sounds of many, many men, by their tens of thousands, lining up opposite the Theodosian walls. In the camp of the Ottomans, Mehmed had decided on a real frontal assault, this time better organized, carried out by Azab infantry and smaller contingents of his janissaries. His janissaries would work in conjunction with a naval assault against the mouth of the Golden Horn's harbor entrance. It was Mehmed's intention that if one assault failed and the other successful, he could still have a chance at taking the city that day. From all accounts, the Ottomans assembled some 15,000 Azab infantry, supported by about 2,000 janissaries. They were broken up in groups of 500 men and placed into key positions meant to support the Azab assault. The Azabs were equipped with smaller blades and axes and were lightly armored. They also had special groups of men who had trained with ladders, like you saw in Lord of the Rings with the orcs trying to go over the city walls. Realizing what the Ottomans were up to, Giustiniani moved his 700 men to the place where he estimated they were going to launch their main attack. The Ottomans attacked late that morning against the walled fortification. The going was slow, and under the hot sun, the Byzantines shot arrows, rocks, and boiling water down upon the attackers. A few Azab infantry did manage to get on top of the ramparts, but just like in Lord of the Rings, they were isolated, cut off, and annihilated. Mehmed watched all of this from his tent, angrily raging at his generals as the attack began to lose steam, and his men were falling back with heavy losses and lots of injuries. However, more bad news was arriving. The Ottoman fleet, under the command of Admiral Bataglu, set out with 50 or more ships, all of various design and operational ability that is way too much detail to get into with this podcast. This small armada attacked the Christian ships, whom they outnumbered. The idea was to drive off or sink the Christian ships who were guarding the entrance to the harbor, then get to work removing the great chain which shut the harbor off to the Turkish warships. if the Turks had managed to get into the harbor of the Golden Horn, then they'd be on the unprotected side of the Constantinople Horn. From here, they would be able to ferry in troops from Mehmed's army and then flank the defenders, all of which would have been bad news for Constantine and his city. However, although the Ottomans outnumbered the Christian vessels, the enemy they faced were crewed by some of the absolute best seamen the entire world had seen up till that point. After all, we must remember that the Catholic West was the culture which produced Christopher Columbus, after all. The sailors on these Christian vessels were all professionals and well paid, and led by the best sea captains in the Mediterranean. The human factor wasn't the only thing on their side either. They also had superior vessels, technically speaking. Their ships were higher than the Ottomans, for starters. If we were to compare the two designs, and I'm using an analogy here since I'm not really a navy guy, the Ottomans were in small four-door sedans, but there was lots of them, while the Christians were riding in a few dozen semi-trailers, giant trucks that could simply plow over the smaller sedans. The superior height of the Christian vessels meant that when the Ottoman ships came in close, the Christians could fire down upon them in a superior tactical position. Admiral Bataglu was aware of these advantages. However, he gave the order for his flagship to rise the triple crescent, the signal for a frontal assault. The Christian vessels put out their oars and their sails as the Ottomans were making straight at them. The Ottomans shot flaming arrows, metal bolts, and small cannons. However, the heavily armored enemy shrugged off these assaults with little effort. Becoming desperate now, and fully aware that Mehmed was watching from the coastline, Bataglu ordered his vessels to ram into the Christian hulks, and then board them and use their superior numbers and marines to fight man-to-man and then take the ships that way. However, due to the Christian superior height, they easily repulsed a majority of these efforts. After his two failed attempts on the 15 or 18 giant Christian vessels, Bataglu noticed that the Christian enemy was now headed straight for the Ottoman fleet. Mehmed was on the coastline, cussing and raising up all kinds of hell, but he could only rage impotently as the Christian bows from their vessels plowed down the smaller Ottoman ships, and their sailors were shot with arrows as they floundered in the ocean. What few boarding parties did manage to make it onto the decks of the enemy vessels, the Christians cut them down mercilessly with axes and swords till they were all annihilated. The Christian ships then shot flaming arrows of their own, which found their marks, and many Ottoman ships were soon ablaze. We don't have exact numbers on the Ottoman naval losses for those days, but it must have been heavy. The Ottomans pulled back and tightened their blockade of the city, and Admiral Bataglu ordered more ships to set sail from Gallipoli to reinforce his losses. The morning of April the 19th opened with two massive assaults and failures against the defenders of Constantinople. Mehmed was so furious he wanted to take the dead bodies of his fallen men from the assault the day earlier and hurl them over the walls and cause infectious diseases within the city. He was dissuaded from this course of action by his staff, the reason being that it would only make occupying the city much more difficult. As for Bataglu, his time was almost at an end as far as Mehmed was concerned. He wouldn't meet his end during the conquest of Constantinople, and he would be lucky to escape with his life. We will get more into the fate of Bataglu and the final series of assaults which brought the city of Constantinople down in later episodes. I'd like to take a moment and give a special shout out to Soren Narnia over at Knife Point Horn for agreeing to narrate the primary source material you've just heard in this Conquest series. You can find a link to his stuff in the show notes, and I invite you to check his work out. Thanks, and I can't wait to jump back into the conquest. Until we meet next time, thank you.